Hey, good morning, everyone. There is not much physical presence today, but I guess people may be online, or you will be watching this session on recording. This is an extra session that we're running on the course because there were some leftovers from the session 3, namely parts 3 and 4 and of the cyber physical systems security part of the course. So for the next let's say 2 hours, more or less, maybe less, I'll go through this material, not in very much detail, but of course the details are in the lecture notes and in the supporting documentation of the course. So you will be able to go into more detail on your own. Now, in this part, we will discuss first of all the framework of how we will talk about vulnerabilities, threats, and attacks on cyber physical systems, and then we'll look into threats, into vulnerabilities, into attacks, and into generic controls, security controls that can be applied to thwart these threats and attacks. So the framework is nothing new; it's just putting together again several things. It's a three-dimensional framework. On one axis, the x-axis, you have the CPS components, and as we discussed in the first part of session 3, there are three components in a cyber physical system. There's a cyber component, there's a cyber physical component, and there's a physical component. Then on the vertical axis and the z-axis, you have aspects of security, and these are the ones that I said that we will discuss. So threats, vulnerabilities, attacks, and controls. And all this discussion is taking place within the context of examples of cyber-physical systems. In this case, industrial control systems, smart grid, medical devices, and smart cars. What we will discuss follows the source that you can see below, where you can find all this material, and I suggest that you study this to get more insight into what we will be discussing today. Okay, so the general threat model that we assume here is that there is always a source of a threat. This is the initiator of an attack, and threat sources can be any one of these types. There we have adversarial threats, we have accidental threats, and we have environmental threats. Of course, there are several ways of classifying threats. We have discussed a few, but for this, for today's discussion, this is what the assumption about the classification of threats goes. It's not a big deal of changing this threat model and assuming other types of threats. As you will see, this is possible. Just a way of organizing the discussion. There is always a target. Targets are applications of cyber-physical systems and their components, or possibly their users. Then there is a motive. Any attacker against the CPS usually would have one or more reasons to launch an attack. And the ones suggested by the specific source that we're using here are criminal, spying, terroristic, political, or cyber, where I would add that unfortunately there is also another class of motives, and this is just for fun. But this is decaying nowadays. We're moving more towards the organized, let's say, type of motive, which is usually financial or political or any one of those that you can see there. Then the attack vector, which is the way that a threat materializes. So this could be one or more of four mechanisms to attack, to intercept communication, traffic, messages, or information, to interrupt traffic, messages, and so on, to modify information, or to fabricate information. And then comes the consequence of the successful attack, which is always compromising the confidentiality, integrity, or availability of information in the CPS or of the system itself, or privacy, or safety. And this The last characteristic, of course, is unique to cyber physical systems. That doesn't apply to what we would call a traditional IT system. We'll go through examples of these types of threats that I mentioned before. I will not go into detail in all of them for the benefit of time. So under the category of criminal threats, an example of such a threat in industrial control systems, well, you can have an attacker who is familiar with the system. This is the source of the threat. Could exploit wireless capabilities. This is the vector. To remotely control an industrial control system application and possibly disrupt its operations. So this is the consequence. What is missing there, of course, is the target, which is, that is the industrial control system application. And there is no reference to the motive. But since this is an insider attack, the motive could be a disgruntled employee, for example. This is the most usual cause. And another example of such a threat, you could have thieves. This is the source. Who aim to rob a house, this is the target now, who might be able to infer private information, such as the presence of the owners or the inhabitants of the house, from the communications between the smart meter and the utility company, this is the attack vector in our case, so that they can perform a successful robbery, which is, of course, the consequence in this particular case. And then we can have criminal threats in medical devices. There are several things that one can be done here. In fact, this is not one threat, but it's two. An attacker in the first case, that's the source, might aim to harm a patient and affect her health condition. This is the target. By using wireless tools to inject or retransmit, this is a replay attack actually, this is the vector, to change the device's state and expected operations. And of course the outcome or the consequence could be an undesired health condition, sometimes even death. There is of course other cases for medical devices here. Similarly, in smart cars, attackers could attack the ECUs or one ECU, electronic control unit of a smart card, by exploiting a weakness in the wireless interfaces. Then there are many there. This is the vector to cause either a collision or a loss of control, like, for example, in the case of the Jeep that was hacked, where the brake system was affected, and this is the consequence. Further, we have financial threats. For example, if you want to, not you, but someone, an attacker, which is a source, a capable customer, aiming to reduce a utility bill, like, for example, the electricity bill, might be able to tamper with the physical equipment or inject false data, this is the vector, to misinform the utility. And, of course, this would cause a financial consequence. An example of that is tampering with smart meters in the case of the smart grid, and this is what is coming up. Actually, there are several ways where an attacker can trick a utility company. Many of them have been published in the past. They have been patched. We now have security solutions that make this not an easy task, but it is still it is still unfortunately possible. Or other consequences might be thought of, like, for example, the Ukraine incident, where the consequence was financial in the sense that there was a blackout which caused a huge financial impact, but had nothing to do with the attacker's own gain from that. Then, political threats. Well, again, we do have cases of alleged attacks sponsored by nations against other nations, primarily against critical infrastructures. The energy infrastructure is a good example, and there have been several such cases. But of course, this could also include nuclear plants or gas pipelines, either by spreading malware or by accessing field devices. And in some times, this has resulted into a complete plant shutdown or in power outages or even in physical damage of equipment, like in the case of the German steel mill that we have discussed, or the pipeline in Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. In the case of smart grids, we have discussed this, and again, there are several large-scale blackouts that have been inflicted by threats like these. Under medical devices, possibly the best example here is the fact that the former vice president of the United States had the wireless capabilities disabled in his pacemaker because the security services thought that he could be the target of an assassination threat by fiddling with his pacemaker. This is not something that can be done easily, but it is possible, and therefore the risk there was considered to be high. In smart cars, in the smart cars case, again, you could have politically motivated threats, because a nation might initiate cyber war by attacking, again, the infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure, potentially causing large-scale collisions, critical injuries, things like that. There is, as far as I can recall, there is no incident as such, or any alleged incident as such, but this is something that we could expect in the future when the smart transportation infrastructure is in place and the number of autonomous and smart vehicles in smart highways will be dominating. If we come to privacy threats, medical devices here is a very good domain for examples of privacy threats. Medical data has always been a very good target for attackers for financial reasons. The recent example of ransomware that hit also hospitals, in which case, of course, we're not strictly speaking about medical devices, but medical devices in the general sense, to the extent that medical information that was also stored in medical devices was affected by ransomware attacks against hospitals. But of course, there are other opportunities for attacking medical devices, the privacy of information in medical devices. And this is possible because of the really weak authentication mechanisms in medical devices, particularly those that are transplantable, as we will see when we will be discussing vulnerabilities. In smart cars, private conversations can be intercepted in a car by exploiting several vulnerabilities, mainly the wireless communication systems within the car, or with more exotic means, like, for example, getting into the car's network by attacking the network hotspots on the exterior mirrors of the car. This is an example of an attack or a vulnerability that we will see later. Still several other examples of threats that we can identify against smart cars. As I said, I'm not going to go into this detailed discussion about all these. What is important here is to realize that there is a lot of possibilities for threats against cyber physical systems, and to be able to describe each one of them in terms of the characteristics that we have introduced. So the source, the target, the vector, the consequence, and so on and so forth. And of course, there are other threats that one may come up with on their own. Coming to physical threats, remember that the cyber-physical system, of course, has a physical component, and therefore it's straightforward to think that there would be physical threats against cyber-physical systems. So in the case of the industrial control systems, an easy to think threat is that an attacker of any kind could spoof a sensor that measures, for example, the temperature of a specific environment, like a target, by either heating that or cooling the sensor down. And this could result in sending misleading false measurements to the control center. And if, for example, the control algorithm is such that it would shut down the process if a sensor or a number of sensors indicated high or very high or very low temperatures, then this could result in disruption of the service. In the case of the smart grids, it's possible to sabotage or to vandalize components of the smart grids that are physically exposed, and these are many. The smart grid is components of the smart grid are everywhere. Not all of them are physically guarded or even monitored, and therefore this is possible to do. And the consequence could be, of course, service disruption, potential blackouts, and so on. If you go to the medical devices case, one could physically tamper a device with the goal of either disrupting the medical service or to change the configurations so that the medical service that the user would expect is not possible to deliver, and in extension of that, an undesired health condition could result. In the smart cars, of course, they are very physically exposed by nature, by definition. So it's not a very challenging task to get access to a car and either attach a malicious device or tamper with the external parts. I did mention to you the exterior mirrors, which have been targets of attack of attackers in a smart car, to achieve very different goals. One could be simply tracking or to causing accidents of any kind of magnitude. Now, moving on into vulnerabilities that we can identify in cyber-physical systems. Again, because of the nature of cyber-physical systems, one would expect to have cyber-physical and physical vulnerabilities. And we can also classify them using the causes of these vulnerabilities. And these are mainly three in cyber-physical systems. So one is the assumption about the isolation, and this we have discussed in a previous session. All cyber-physical systems, or most of the cyber-physical systems, because this is a new concept, have evolved from the combination of cyber and physical systems, where the physical systems were designed to be controlled by cyber components under the assumption that they would be isolated from the outside world. In other words, they would not be a pathway from the internet or from any other outside location outside the process control plant to these systems. And unfortunately, this assumption doesn't hold anymore. So, in effect, what I'm saying is that those systems had been designed with no security in mind, simply because it was not needed, because they would be physically isolated. Now, this assumption doesn't hold anymore, and this is creating many vulnerabilities in cyber-physical systems. Another source of vulnerability is the increased connectivity. Not only we have been connecting cyber-physical systems to the networks that are not operational networks, but are, even to the internet directly or indirectly, but we are doing so increasingly, and this is of course because what we have to gain is more business intelligence or advanced capability of decision making support, And this is why we do connect these cyber-physical systems together. So the more you increase the connectivity of a cyber-physical system, or of any system in effect, be that even IT traditional systems, the more vulnerabilities are caused because of this connectivity. And the third cause of vulnerabilities in our case is heterogeneity. Cyber-physical systems are built ad hoc. So it wouldn't be surprising to have a cyber-physical system that is actually putting together several components that have never been designed to be put together. So the resulting system may be, and usually is, a large-scale system whose components can be designed individually and separately and have been put together not as a result of a holistic design of the whole system, but as an ad hoc compilation of components. And this means that this heterogeneity does create vulnerabilities because of the fact that the system has not been designed holistically from the beginning. So, examples of vulnerabilities. If we start with cyber vulnerabilities and the case of industrial control systems, we first of all can see communication vulnerabilities in the cyber components of such industrial control systems. There are vulnerable protocols there, vulnerable communication protocols, because they have not been designed with security in mind, again, due to the isolation assumption. The use of Ethernet and fiber optics in industrial environments. And then moving on to wireless communications, either short range or long range, all the vulnerabilities of the traditional IT systems that you can find in such environments of wireless communications are inherited to industrial control systems, of course. Under software vulnerabilities, this is another class of vulnerabilities within the overarching class of cyber vulnerabilities. Of course, SQL injection is there. Emails is a usual technique for attacking, for using social engineering, in fact, techniques for attacking such systems. And we have seen examples of that. And also vulnerabilities in internet exposed devices that are connected to the local network, or maybe combination of those can result in an attack. So, for example, social engineering techniques with internet exposed devices was the attack vector in the case of the Belgacom incident that we have discussed. In the case of the smart grid, again, communication vulnerabilities, the internet protocols that are used, they inherit, of course, all the vulnerabilities of the IP stack, and then a very specific protocol that is being used for data exchange between control centers, ICCP, and it's known to have a critical buffer overflow vulnerability. I'm not sure whether this has been corrected already, but... this should be actually checked. And then software vulnerabilities can be are the same as in the overall case of the industrial control systems. We have widespread smart meters that are remotely upgradable. Remember that the ability or the inability to upgrade software in cyber-physical systems was has been found to be, and we have discussed it, one of the characteristics of cyber-physical systems that constrained our ability to secure them. So here, this is discussed as a vulnerability rather than as a limitation or a constraint, in the sense that since these smart meters are remotely upgradable, that means that an attacker could interfere with the upgrade process and upgrade instead of upgrading legitimate software, upload software that is infected with malware as well. Some vendors leave backdoors. This is, I would say, typical practice in vendors, not only in cyber-physical systems, but in all kinds of IT by the systems, and these of course can be exploited. Then privacy vulnerabilities under the smart grid, they all come under the privacy problems that we have with the smart metering infrastructure in the smart grid. And there are several concerns there that not all of them have been addressed satisfactorily. In medical devices, again, the problem of security through obscurity. The manufacturers of medical devices never thought that these could be the target of cyber attacks, and therefore they just, wherever security was considered, it was considered with an approach of security through obscurity, that is, using proprietary protocols, and we know that this is not a good idea because proprietary protocols have been found not to be secure enough when people are able to analyze them. Then there are vulnerabilities related to the communication among cyber components in medical devices. These are mostly, if not exclusively, wireless communications, with all the vulnerabilities of air interfaces in wireless communications, and of course the usually complete lack of encryption in all of these communications. That doesn't make it very easy to attack a medical device over the wireless interface, because usually the signals are so weak in intention for medical reasons, so that the attacker would have to be quite close to the device. But still, this is a severe vulnerability. Then there is a class of software vulnerabilities here. There is an increasingly large number of medical devices that are being recalled nowadays because software defects have been identified. Strictly speaking, this is not related directly to the security of the medical device. It is, of course, related directly to the safety of the patient, and because it is related to a cyber component, namely software, this is why this is mentioned here. Buffer overflows have been found. Buffer overflow vulnerabilities have been identified in specific medical devices. As I already said, usually these devices have very weak, if any, authentication mechanisms, sometimes only a PIN, or sometimes even nothing. Improper credential storage has been found to be quite common in medical devices, and also unauthorized firmware update has been reported as a problem with medical devices. In fact, medical devices is a field where much concern has been put regarding its security, because they are related, of course, to human safety, and because this is an increasingly important field and market. And this is why a whole program under the Horizon program, a whole call for proposals is devoted to the security of medical devices. This is going to be announced in the coming months, or it has been already announced, and the proposals are due sometime in spring. If we move to smart cars, again, communications, we have cellular interfaces in a smart car. There is the use of Bluetooth, notoriously insecure ways of communication, and also the lack of encryption. Yeah, you will see the lack of encryption coming again and again as one of the sources of the vulnerabilities in several cyber-physical systems. One could wonder, okay, if lack of encryption is such an important and recurring problem, then why don't we simply use encryption? One part of the answer, and I would say a significant part of the answer, is that we cannot always use encryption, simply because encryption takes time, encryption and decryption takes time, and because many cyber-physical system applications are time-critical as well, injecting encryption solutions into such an application with the time overhead that this induces could possibly do more harm than good, in the sense that it could defeat the purpose of the cyber-physical system in extreme situations or even under normal operation. Software vulnerabilities, software bugs have been identified, not always unintentional if you think about the Volkswagen case. Malicious code injection has been reported. A very specific vulnerability is the connection, the link between the media player and the controller area network bus in smart cars, which is typical practice, and this does create an additional vulnerability. Then, under the class of cyber physical vulnerabilities in industrial control systems, again, we have a subclass of communication vulnerabilities due to communication between ICS components. And the listings here are insecure protocols. These are Modbus and DMP3 are typically used protocols in industrial control systems with not much security, if any, in place by design. Also, direct access to remote field devices such as RTUs and PLCs that are directly connected to the internet. PLCs have not been designed to be directly connected to the internet, so this is again one small violation of the design, in the sense that when you use something which has not been designed for a purpose other than the one it has been designed, then you're looking for vulnerabilities actually. And then, so the existence of secondary communication channels, like, for example, dial-up channels. Then, operating system vulnerabilities related to cyber-physical systems have also been reported. So, real-time operating systems do not always implement access control measures. And applications that are used for controlling and monitoring field devices are running on general purpose OS, so it's not uncommon to see a regular PC running an application to control or monitor field devices. Sometimes, even worse, the situation is even worse, because these PCs may still run Windows XP and sometimes Windows 98. Which, of course, is not a very good idea, but one of the engineering real-world practices is that, well, if it works, don't change it, and therefore, why should a system upgrade to a more modern and therefore more secure version of Windows, for example, if this would mean that possibly the whole application, monitoring on control application, would have to be redesigned or re-implemented. And then software vulnerabilities. Well, lack of code integrity controls at PLCs. Code in PLCs is not usually written in any high-order language. It's usually low-order languages, very close to the hardware. And these devices do not really have the capability, as they are, of doing code integrity checks in normal operation. In fact, there has been a discussion that we are having with colleagues in Singapore, the Singapore University of Technology and Design. But this is a very preliminary, of course, it is just a research idea. Is it possible to use watermarking, for example, to somehow enforce integrity, code integrity control with PLCs? As I said, this is very preliminary, but it's a really interesting challenge there. The second bullet there we have I already touched upon, that there's a large number of PLCs that directly connect to the internet, even though this was not meant to be so, and backdoors in several field devices put there by the vendors. Moving on to the smart grids, grid communication, again, suffers from insecure or at least partially insecure protocols and also heterogeneous components that are run by different entities. This means that the domain of control is fragmented, and having a fragmented domain of control is a good source of vulnerability, usually leaving gaps between these domains. Smart meters, we already mentioned, backdoors there as a vulnerability. Coming to medical devices, they almost exclusively rely upon wireless communications, with all the vulnerabilities that wireless communications have, in addition to not having encryption in place and having also weak authentication mechanisms. So specific vulnerabilities there are replay attacks. This is quite typical in medical devices and not so difficult to implement because of the lack of encryption. And device authentication itself. Then moving on to smart cars, the protocols that are being used for in-vehicle communication, for example, CAN and LIN, they don't have encryption in place. Authentication also and authorization mechanisms are, say, primitive for the time being. Comfort ECUs are those ECUs that relate to the passenger comfort and entertainment, and these have not been designed with much security in mind. And also vulnerabilities with all these components by wire, so steer by wire, drive by wire, brake by wire, shift by wire, and throttle by wire, all are subsystems of a smart car that cause vulnerabilities when put together in the same vehicle. Then coming to the physical, purely physical vulnerabilities in cyber-physical systems, in industrial control, but they're mostly the same in the different categories of systems that we are considering today. So under the industrial control systems, we have the vulnerability of physical exposure of many components with insufficient physical security. Same with the smart grids, in which case we also have, in addition, field devices that are placed in unprotected environments and usually over large areas, they span large areas. In medical devices, sometimes they could be vulnerable to physical access when the patient is in an insecure location. And with smart cards, parts could be destroyed. Physical access to onboard diagnostics is possible, and access to the internal network, the example I mentioned to you already, through exterior exposed components, for example, the exterior mirrors, is possible. So we've discussed threats and vulnerabilities. What follows is a table with possible attacks that can be launched against the four examples, the four classes of cyber-physical systems that we are considering. Again, I will not take the time to go into much detail into these tables. This is a summary, actually, of the discussion that you can find in the source mentioned there. And I recommend that you go through it, because the table by itself would not give you all the information that is in the detailed discussion. But just to give you an indication of how the table works, first of all, the legend under IE up there, we mean influenced element, and then I is influence, and AE is the affected element. So just one example of attacks, and these are attacks that have been documented in the literature, so one can find the details of the attack even by looking at the literature, which is cited in the source here. So an example is pumps, and the influenced element, of course, is the pumps here. The influence is that they don't work as they should, so they work undesirably. The affected element is the correct settings in the pumping stations had been manipulated. So this is actually how the attack was manifested. And the impact there was that raw sewage flood in streets These were pumps used in a sewage system. So this was the direct impact, and then cascading impact was a tainted environment and financial losses, of course, for the company that was running the sewage control system. The method used was a laptop and a radio transmitter to manipulate the pumps, so over the wireless communication interface. And the precondition, there was insider knowledge of how these pumps operate and how the wireless communications were set up and so on and so forth. So you can go through the different attacks there in a similar manner. If we move to the smart grid, again, an example. The name of the attack, let's call it cyber extortion. The influenced element was the delivery of power. The influence was that utilities lose control over the grid system, and the affected elements are the customers here. The impact is loss of services and financial losses as well. And the method was, once again, the exploitation of internet-connected smart grid components. Precondition, here again, inside knowledge. To successfully attack most of the cyber-physical systems, some form of inside knowledge needs to be there. The extent of that inside knowledge varies from cyber-physical system to cyber-physical system, and also from the attack vector to another attack vector, but internal knowledge needs to be there. In some form. Going to medical devices, a usual attack is a DOS attack against medical devices. So the influence is that the device is turned off, and of course the patient that carries the device is affected because they don't receive the expected therapy. You can consider, for example, a transplantable insulin pump that is attacked by denial of service attack, and therefore it stops administering the correct dose of insulin to the patient. And the method, a simple method of doing that, is a replay of a turn-off command. Remember that we mentioned that these devices, the wireless communication, lacks encryption. It is really not very difficult to launch a replay attack against the medical device. So, and this is actually the precondition there, that you have to somehow capture a turn-off command that is being sent to the device, possibly for maintenance purposes or for reconfiguration. If you go to the smart cars. Again, there are several here. The first one is a DOS attack, where the result is a sudden drop in the speedometer. And the precondition was, in this particular case, to have a physical access to the CAN bus. Of course, the method was to disable the communication with the BCM in this case. And in fact, there are more attacks manifested against smart cars. This is a popular area for both exploring possibilities and also for writing papers on possible attacks and how these can be thwarted and so on. Okay, so this then brings us to the end of part three, and I think this is a good point to have a short break before we move on to the security controls that one can find in cyber-physical systems. So we'll be back, possibly not 15 minutes, probably earlier than that. Well, I guess we can start again. So, as promised, we'll talk about security controls that have been proposed for several cyber-physical systems. So, I'll start about talking about general CPS controls, and then again the three elements or the three components of a cyber-physical system. So, controls for the cyber part, for the cyber-physical part, and for the physical part, and then a very special type of controls for control mechanisms, which are called moving target defense, as applied to cyber physical systems. Okay, so under the general controls, one can list controls against the more connectivity. And under this goes, of course, the general class of protocol hardening, usually through encryption, mostly through encryption. Then communication controls. These are similar to those that we would use in, let's say, a traditional ICT, information communication technology system, but considering the differences. And a good example of the need to consider differences is, again, the timeliness requirement of a cyber-physical system as opposed to that of an ICT system. And then device attestation has been proposed as one general type of control. So the use of the concept of trusted platform modules for CPS has been proposed. The difficulty there, in addition to the difficulties for adopting TPM solutions in traditional ICT systems, is that CPSs come with limited resources, and systems with limited resources do not easily support TPM functions. Now, coming into the cyber part, so controls for the cyber part of a CPS. Again, under the classes, the example classes of CPSs that we examine here, industrial control systems, encryption and key management is a control that has been proposed. It's not easy to adopt because of delays. Then software controls have been proposed. The problem there, the usual problem, is to keep up with current versions of OS. I already mentioned this in the previous session. Not only the difficulty of upgrading to a new version of an OS because the application might stop operating as intended is there, but also the difficulty of upgrading a huge number sometimes of devices with newer versions of operating systems. And then the standardization is progressing fast in the area, but still, as usual, standardization is behind development, technological developments. In the smart grid arena, controls for thwarting denial of service attacks have been proposed. Controls have been proposed for thwarting the privacy attacks, and this is the use of privacy preserving protocols there, and also controls have been proposed for the false data injection attacks that can happen in smart grids. In medical devices, in the field of medical devices, it has been proposed to shift security to wearable devices rather than on the controlling application on the physician's side. Also, cross-domain solutions have been proposed, and also, again, standardization and recommendations are in progress, but still not to an extent that covers the field. In the smart cars field, There has been a lot of work, research work as well being done, and also work being done by the automotive industry in this domain. So there is a lot of controls, and some of them very promising, that have been proposed, but not many of them have been implemented in the real world. And also the use of intrusion detection systems in the smart vehicles has been proposed. We will discuss a little bit in more detail intrusion detection systems for CPSs towards the end of the lecture today. Then in the cyber physical class of controls under ICS, new design has been proposed. You can easily see the difficulties with implementing this kind of control, redesigning big parts of industrial control systems. Protocols with add-on security have been proposed, and they are in operation. In fact, many of the industrial control systems protocols are being injected with security controls. Intrusion detection again, and remote access to field devices has also been proposed as a control rather than as a vulnerability, which one would expect to be. Then, in the case of the smart grids, intrusion detection appears again, not surprisingly. Intrusion detection is the last, or the one before last, actually, step that we can take in defense of a system. So if all the preventive measures fail and we do have an intrusion in the system, then the intrusion detection system is the one that will provide us with possible controls that could be applied on the spot to stop an attack that is already happening or is about to happen. The last defense line is, of course, the logs. This is not really a defense line, but at least it can give us information on what has happened exactly and how this can be prevented from being repeated, and also to make a case possibly for a legal case against the attackers. So IDS you will see everywhere. Then low-level authorization authentication has been proposed to be added to the smart grid functionality. New designs, again, security extensions, and the disabling prevention of smart meters. In the medical devices field, again, IDS authentication has been proposed, because it's simply mostly absent from medical devices. Also, the use of location-based controls has been proposed. So, for example, one proposal has been that if a transplantable device is to be reconfigured, it cannot be reconfigured unless it finds itself in a specific location, which, of course, normally would be the physician's premises where the device should be reconfigured. Thwarting active and passive attacks has also been proposed as a control there, and allowing or disallowing remote functionalities. There is a very sensitive balance there. By disallowing remote functionality, of course, one can increase security, but it's not always the case that safety remains unaffected, and this is a very difficult decision to take, which should be made on the basis of risk analysis of both the security aspects and the safety aspects of the option to allow or disallow. In the domain of smart cars, one proposal has been to restrict critical commands, so that even if someone, an attacker, gets access to the network, to the in-vehicle network, then he or she would not be able to execute specific commands that are critical to the vehicle. The abolishment of Bluetooth has also been recommended, but for obvious commercial reasons, this is not possibly a good idea to do. The use of cryptography for in-vehicle communications has been proposed, and then there has been at least one proposal for redefining the trust mechanisms within the in-vehicle network so as to increase the endurance of the network towards outside attackers. Under physical controls, you wouldn't expect to see much. It's actually the same in all cases. Physical security is there. So physical security controls should be and have been proposed to be applied. Of course, they would differ in nature according to the specific to every application there. But it's primarily the same kind of thing, physically protect the ICS or the smart grid or the medical devices or the smart card. Okay, and this brings us now then to the to a special category of controls for CPS that have a kind of an interest, because it's kind of a let's say different kind of controls than the ones that we are used to dealing with. The philosophy here is this: how about making the life of a potential attacker a bit more difficult than it is by presenting him or her not with a static picture of what he or she will be attacking, but of a dynamic, in the sense that it changes picture of the target. So let's say in a more formal way, we can define moving target defense as a concept. It's a game-changing concept that allows defenders to alter the attack surface of a system, and this hopefully makes the system penetration more difficult to attackers. Of course, it doesn't only apply to cyber-physical systems. Moving target defense originated from the traditional ICT systems. So what we will be looking into is how these this kind of defense has been ported to the CPS domain. Original ideas behind moving target defense: address space randomization and internet protocol hopping. Now, these were the original ideas behind MTD, but of course now it has evolved more, and more techniques have been proposed, and examples of these are software behavior encryption and address randomization under IPv6. Of course, this is not a different concept than the initial internet protocol hopping or the address randomization, but still it is a different and more modern technique. So a classification of categories of MTD is here. The first class is what is called dynamic runtime environment, which changes the environment during execution. And this breaks down into two different subclasses. One is address space randomization, and the other one is the instruction set randomization. Then another class is dynamic software, which means changing the application code dynamically by modifying the program instructions, or their order, or their grouping, or their format, thus making it more difficult for the attacker to analyze what the software is doing. Or the third class is dynamic networks, which practically means reconfiguring network properties. So, for example, properties of the network that can be changed is the randomization of the IP addresses, or the TCP port that is being used, or the trust nodes that are being used in the network. Then we have dynamic platforms, in which class the configuration of platforms, and by platforms we mean operating systems and CPUs, change randomly or during the operation of the system, and the properties of such platforms that can change is possibly the version of the operating system, or the instance, or the architecture of the CPU. And then the last category here is the dynamic data, in which case what we do change is the properties of the data. So, for example, the format of the data, the syntax, or the representations of the data. MTD is a defense strategy, but that doesn't mean that it cannot be attacked itself. This is a more general observation that by introducing security controls, we do, in fact, thwart possible attacks that the controls have been designed to thwart. But at the same time, we may introduce new vulnerabilities that can be exploited by other types of threats. So MTD is not an exception to the rule, and there are several attacks that can be launched against an MTD. Again, these are not specific to cyber-physical systems. They are more general to any kind of MTD. And these are that, first of all, there can be a brute force attack against MTD or a bypass. So, for example, if you go for a randomization of the address space out of the instruction set or whatever randomization option, if the randomization space is, if the random space is small, that means that an attacker can possibly exercise brute force to find out which exactly combination of properties you're using. Another way of attacking MTD is to try to predict MTD techniques. Well, it's not really very easy to do truly random choices, not only in MTD, but in any case that calls for randomization. In fact, what we are usually doing in practice is a pseudo-randomization. Now, if this is the case, an attacker may try to predict the MTD technique, and sometimes, if enough data is there, an attacker can successfully analyze them to find the randomization pattern that is being used. Another possibility for the attacker is to limit the choice of movement. So again, this is an example is with address space randomization. If the attacker is able to write up memory, that means that he or she can limit the randomization possibilities, and therefore then a brute force attack can be used. And the last class of attacks goes under the label disabling movement. So what this means is the attacker would turn off or impede MTD from operating. So, for example, one way of doing that is if there is a randomization of configuration either in the operating system or any other aspect of the platform, then the attacker could possibly push a bad configuration and within the options of the MTD designer, and that means that the attacker would be able to bring down the system without doing much, but actually being helped by the MTD strategy. Now, if we turn our attention to MTD for network security, what you can see on the left-hand upper corner of this slide, these are attacks on a cyber-physical system. Well, it's a simplified version, of course, but it does show you places where an attack can take place. So what we have in a cyber-physical system, then this is a simplified representation. We have a physical system, and then we have the controller of that physical system. We're going to be using this simplified representation of a CPS in the next part, the next and last part of the lecture, which is on intrusion detection. So the attacker's overall goal is to end up with what we call there a compromised physical system. Now, all these arrows there are connections, of course. The darker ones are the ones that should be there in a normal operation, and those that are lighter are those that result from the attacker's actions. And all these A's are possible attacks against the CPS that an attacker can launch. Now, in the right-hand lower side of the slide, what you can see is a table that maps MTD techniques that can be used to address, and have been used actually, to address such types of attacks against a cyber-physical system. The reference for all this material for MTD you can see on your left, and again, it's a good idea to go through that into more detail, as we are not taking all the time needed to go into this level of detail here in the lecture. So an example of how this table works is that if you are concerned, let's say if you want to see how MTD can be used for thwarting A4 or A9 attacks. A4 is actually a DOS attack that you can see up there. So it's between the physical system and the controller. The category under which the proposed solution falls is dynamic network. And there are two tools that can be used to implement such a kind of dynamic network configuration. One is called Dynabone. You can look them up in Google, and the other one is MD6D. Don't bother with the details of the systems. These are there for reference and for those of you that possibly have increased interest in this. And then the last column of the table gives you whether an extension for cyber-physical systems exists. This is because originally these solutions have been developed for traditional ICT systems, and therefore it's not necessary that they come for the CPS domain. And the first row of the table actually is a good example because Dynabone doesn't have an extension for CPS, whereas MT6D does have an extension for CPS. And then you can go on with the rest of the attacks there. If you will notice, these are actually network attacks only. So A4, A9, and then A2 and A10 is actually not a disruption attack, but it's a packet scheduling, so or possibly also changing the order of the packets there. And then A6 and A11 are again network attacks, but they are passive attacks. It's simply eavesdropping against the network. But of course, there are other types of attacks that are not related to the network itself. So there comes another table that outlines the same information, or actually the respective information, for those attacks that are not directed against the network but against the controller. And an example here, if we go back, is attack A1, which is a deception attack, which can again be mitigated by either using a dynamic network strategy or a dynamic data strategy, and then the rest of the table goes in a similar fashion. A3 is an attack of false information from compromised sensors. So this is the involvement of the compromised physical system into the attack picture. A5 is a replay attack against that originates from the compromised physical system. A7 is a malware attack, which can be launched directly against the controller, not using the network itself, but by other means. Unauthorized access to the controller using credentials that have been, for example, been obtained from legitimate users by using a social engineering attack or any other means that you can think of, or the good old-fashioned buffer overflow attack against the controller, which would, of course, possibly result in a collapse of the controller and therefore the inability of the controller to control the physical system as designed. This is an explanatory slide because if we go back to this table, if you look right here, this is the first row, third case, and also the second row, where a term that I'm not sure that you're familiar with appears, and this is state estimation. So what state estimation is, this is actually a crash course on what state estimation is, but this we will also see into the last part of the lecture when we talk about intrusion detection systems in cyber-physical systems. So state estimation can be graphically depicted here. You actually have a system which you can observe or possibly partially observe, but you can observe several characteristics of the system. So this system, you can take measurements of it and you can give control inputs to the system. State estimation, I would roughly define it as a technique by which, by measuring specific aspects of the system, and by knowing the control that is applied to the system, whether we can estimate or predict the state that the system will find itself under normal conditions. So actually what you can see there is here, that if we have a state estimation block, then by feeding it with the control input and with the measurements or the output of the system, the measurement is the output of the system plus noise, then this could give us a prediction of what the output of the system in the next time instance could be. Now, obviously, if this deviates from what we actually measure in the next time instance, this is a good indication that something is going wrong. And this something could be the result of an attack, hence the use of state estimation techniques in intrusion detection for cyber-physical systems. As I said, we'll come back to that, hopefully, time permitting. And then MTD has also been proposed to be used for physical system security. So again, if you look to the very first slide where the attacks have been described, the A8 attack is a physical attack on the physical system. The same is a holds true for A12. And for these cases, the respective MTD tools have been listed there. As you can see, there are many or significant number of cases where MTD tools or tools for implementing MTD strategies have not been extended to cyber-physical systems. So this is possibly an interesting area to work on. Okay, so this brings us to our last part of the lecture, end of the session actually, which is on intrusion detection. So we will discuss a little bit main concepts. I guess many of you are taking the course on intrusion detection, so possibly you can look upon that course for more insight and more detail on intrusion detection in general. But I will give you an introduction of the main concepts, an overview of the main concepts here. Then we'll talk about distinguishing characteristics of how do we do intrusion detection in cyber-physical systems. A classification of IDSs in CPS, the effectiveness, how do we measure it? And then a special technique of IDS that looks into the physics, actually, of the process that the cyber-physical system is controlling to determine whether an intrusion is taking place, rather than looking at the cyber characteristics or the IT or the network characteristics of the system. And we will end that with open research topics in intrusion detection. That happens to be also one of the research of my research interests here. Okay, so the core intrusion detection functions, what an IDS does. Well, we used to say that it does four things, but this can be actually collapsed into two. It collects data regarding suspects. And in the parentheses, you can see several data or types of data that an IDS can collect. Logging system calls, traffic, gathering, hearsay, reputation scores about the system, and so on. The list is much longer. These are just indicative examples of the diversity of data that an IDS may collect. And then it analyzes the data. How does it do that? Well, there are several techniques, but the most prevalent ones nowadays are, of course, pattern matching or statistical analysis and data mining. What does it do with analyzing the data? Well, the end event, the end result that we would like to have from an IDS, it could be a binary result. So this is good or this is bad. This is an intrusion or this is not an intrusion. Or it can be ternary. So this is an intrusion or this is not an intrusion, or I do not know, or I cannot really conclude. Or it can be a continuous, in the sense that an IDS can give an indication in the form of a probability that a sequence of actions or events constitutes an intrusion or it doesn't constitute an intrusion. Sometimes, I should add to this that intrusion detection systems do have a capability of also telling us what kind of intrusion is happening, of course, provided that they have concluded that there is an intrusion going on. But this is not always there. This capability of classifying the intrusion is not always there. How do we know how they work? And this is, again, mostly the same as in the case of IDS in IT or ICT systems. So it's the false positive rate. What percentage of those incidents, of those events that the IDS identifies as intrusions are not, in fact, intrusions. And this is what we usually call, we commonly call the curse of intrusion detection, because most available and operating in the real world intrusion detection systems today do tend to create very high false positive rates. Then the false negative rate is how many real incidents, real intrusions have not been identified as such by the IDS, and also its complement, the true positive rate. Sometimes the accuracy is defined as the ratio of the true positive over the false positive and the false negative, in which case actually what the accuracy gives you is how accurate is the IDS in identifying intrusions. Then another measure that is being used is the ROC graph. This is the detection rate versus the false positive rate. All these are characteristics related to the intrusion detection capability of the IDS per se, but there are other metrics that are of interest to us. The first being that are not related to the detection capability, but they are related to the performance of the IDS. So the first one is the detection latency. How good is an IDS if it tells you that there has been an intrusion several hours after the intrusion has happened? This is obviously not good at all. And of course, the acceptable latency is a function of the application or of the system that the IDS is supposed to protect. For time-critical applications or systems, the latency, the acceptable latency of the IDS is obviously much less than for those systems that are not time-critical. Similarly, if the system that the IDS protects is, for example, a wireless network or a system that comprises devices of low power capability, then the power consumption of the IDS itself is a metric that should concern us, as well as the communication overhead that the IDS possibly produces, and also the processor load. All these are metrics that are very important when you deploy IDSs in environments where the computational and the communication and the power resources of the elements of the network are very limited. And again, as I said, a typical example is a wireless sensor network. And then the last metric that goes under this category is the packet sampling efficiency, how frequently the IDS has to sample the packets, if it has, as compared to the detection accuracy that it achieves. Okay, now, what's so different about IDSs in CPS? You would expect, of course, that there would be differences from ICT, otherwise this wouldn't have been a different topic to discuss. So one distinguished characteristic is the physical process monitoring. An IDS in a CPS measures physical properties. It doesn't monitor. It can, but it doesn't monitor host or network level user or machine activity. So laws of physics are there. And this is a very big difference from a traditional ICT IDS. Then another difference is stemming from the closed control loop. Usually, the CPS environment that the IDS is supposed to protect are automated, and they are time-driven, so the timeliness requirement comes here again in a closed-loop setting. So that means, this is good actually in this case, because a closed-loop setting that has been designed to operate in a very specific way, as a CPS usually does, gives you some regularity and some predictability for behavior. And this is in contrast to a traditional ICT system, because there the user is very much less predictable, if at all predictable, because the user is a human being, and this usually leads to high FPRs in traditional ICT IDSs. Another one is the sophistication of the attacks. The first thing to note here is that the payoff from a successful attack against the CPS is substantial. This also may be true for several ICT systems as well. Imagine a banking system, then the payoff can be really very substantial, even much more so than attacking a CPS. But the actual point that is made here, that human safety is at stake from such systems like CPSs, which is not the case usually with ICTs. ICT, traditional ICT systems. Then, a usual source of difficulty when dealing with security in CPSs, we have mentioned it repeatedly up till now in the course, legacy technology. Many of these cyber-physical environments use legacy hardware. And legacy hardware is a source of many difficulties regarding security. Most of them do not provide any capability for adding security, even as an add-on later. They're difficult to modify. They're very costly in replacing with more modern equipment that would give security capability or even physical access. So, when designing an IDS, one would have to, for a CPS, one would have to keep in mind this very special characteristic, because in a nutshell, one could say that an IDS in a CPS environment may have to rely on information from really not very smart or dumb devices, simply because these are legacy devices that they were not designed with this capability in mind. Now, IDSs for cyber-physical systems have been classified. This is a proposal for a classification. The source you can find there, it's a very good survey paper on research work that has appeared in intrusion detection for CPS. So the classification there is based either on the detection technique or on the audit material. You can call the audit material also input information that the IDS uses. So on the detection technique side, there are two basic techniques that have been used for IDSs and CPS. One is knowledge-based, and the other one is behavior-based. And under behavior-based, there is a subclass, which is called behavior specification-based. This we can do in cyber-physical systems, taking advantage of the note that we discussed previously, that their behavior can be much more predictable than and regular than a traditional ICT systems. On the audit material or input information side, the usual classification between host-based and network-based. Actually, this classification is missing what in traditional IDS classification one would call hybrid systems, because we can have IDSs that rely on both on both information provided by host and information provided by the network. Now, if one is to compare the different approaches or techniques that have been used for IDS in cyber-physical systems, then we can note the following things. Let's go with the detection technique first. So the behavior the behavior-based systems, IDSs, they can detect unknown attacks. This is a usual disadvantage, the most commonly referred disadvantage of knowledge-based systems, that they cannot deal with unknown attacks. On the other hand, behavior-based IDSs can deal, or at least in theory, with unknown attacks. And then, if you look at the pros of the behavior specification type of IDSs, not only they can detect unknown attacks because they are behavior based, but they can also have a low false positive rate because they take advantage of that predictability and regularity of a CPS. And the final class there, the knowledge based systems, their advantage over the other classes is that they have low processor demand and low false positive. If no rule in the knowledge-based system is violated, then there is no false positive rate, very low. In the audit material part of the classification, under the host-based systems, their advantages is that they provide distributed control and ease of specification or detection host-level misbehavior, whereas in the case of the network-based systems, we find as an advantage the reduced load on resource-constrained nodes. So again, in a wireless sensor network, which is a good example of such systems, one would rarely go for a host-based system, but one would probably go for a network-based system. Looking at the disadvantages, again, starting with the detection technique, behavior-based ones, they have high false positive positive rate. And this is actually an inherent disadvantage of any behavior-based system, not particularly to CPSs, and the main source of this problem has actually to do with the physics of the thing, that normal and abnormal behavior have a lot of overlap, and therefore there is a rather large area of behavior that one can can be normal, or it can be abnormal, depending on the intention of the subject of the behavior, and which can therefore not be attributed to only abnormal situations. In which case, of course, you end up with false positives. Then, in the behavior specification-based systems, the disadvantage is that a human must instrument the model of the IDS. And in the knowledge case, the usual disadvantage of all knowledge-based IDSs is that we have to somehow inform the system of what attacks are there and how they can be detected, and this, of course, knowledge must be both stored and it must be updated frequently, not to mention the well-known disadvantage that it cannot detect unknown attacks. If you go to the audit material, if you have a host-based IDS, then you have an increased load on resource-constrained nodes, and also the vulnerability of audit material and limited generality. In the network-based ones, the effectiveness is limited by the visibility, so depending on how the IDS is deployed and what kind of information it is taking, it is getting from the network, this may result in the limited visibility of what is going on the network. Of course, one can deploy more sensors, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the visibility may be increased, but not necessarily the insight into what is going on into the network. And for those of you that may be interested in doing more work on IDS for cyber physical systems, this is a table that shows you which of those techniques are mostly used and which are not mostly used. So this is ranked according to the application. So smart utilities are the ones that have troubled the research community most. And then when it comes to detection technique, behavior-based is the most frequently used. In the input sources, Mostly host is being used, but network is close enough. And then the last column will give you some unique CPS aspects there per category of application. Okay, so if we look at it in a more, let's say, compact way, knowledge-based designs, not effective on their own. This is actually a summary of things that we already discussed through the tables. So large storage requirement, requirement for frequent dictionary updates, attack dictionary updates, not able to detect unknown attacks, but on the positive side, they are efficient in the sense that a false positive rate is usually low. So the conclusion with those is that if you're going to use them with another method as well. So not only knowledge-based, but also, let's say, behavior-based, complementing with behavior-based. And actually, this is an interesting research subject. There have been some proposals of putting these two together in several ways, in tandem or in parallel, and there are several things that one can research in this area. Okay, coming to behavior-based designs, they are more effective if they are used in highly redundant CPSs. Such systems can tolerate wrongful eviction because of the redundancy. This is actually an excuse for accepting the high false positive rate that a behavior-based IDS would be expected to produce. Because there is low computational overhead of such systems, there is a margin on the processing capability of the CPS to allow for more efficient mining techniques to run. And the last class on behavior specification based designs are more effective than the others in most of the cases of CPS, simply because they take advantage of the advantages of behavior plus the regularity of the system. When it comes to the audit materials, I guess the conclusion is that network based designs are effective when you have wireless segments. I've mentioned the wireless sensor network as an example in many cases. Host-based auditing is effective if you're having a CPS which is unattended, and this is because the automated operation will give you stable profiles, and the human in the loop in this case would only give you erratic normal data sets because of the non-predictability of the behavior of the human. This is actually a hint towards the hybrid solution of using both network and host-based information in the CPS. Okay, there is really very little time left. People have been knocking on the door to cover the last section on physics-based attack detection in control systems. So I don't really think that this makes sense to cover in this particular case. I will leave it to you for individual study. The source is there. And I would only come to the last slide on open research topics in this area. Again, perhaps some of you are interested in engaging with research in this. So, one topic is to define performance metrics that would make sense specifically for CPS IDSs. The second open issue is to explore the concept of multi-trust. How do we fuse hearsay or reported information into the IDS process for CPSs? Network-based CPSs for IDS, this has received a lot of attention, particularly in the context of wireless sensor networks, but still most of those solutions that have been proposed, or even though there are many, they are only IDSs that are capable of identifying very specific small number of attacks. So a generalization question is open. The audits should focus on application layer data. Again, I would rather twist that a little bit by saying that they should focus also on application layer data. So we should be looking at low-level information coming from the network or the host, depending on what kind of IDS we're designing, but also exploit application layer data. Then develop and validate model-based analysis techniques to analyze the performance of IDS protocols and find the optimal settings to maximize the performance, not only in terms of detection performance or detection accuracy performance, but also taking into account the metrics that we mentioned, like the detection latency or the power consumption or things like that. Then come up with reasonable attacker models. An IDS inherently utilizes an underlying attacker model, so modeling attackers and attacks is important in this area. Look into more detail into the behavior specification-based detection and specifically into the threshold monitoring technique and whether this can be used with behavior specification-based. Have a look into the possibility of not only stopping at the detection of an intrusion, but also the intrusion detection system being able of taking controls so that it would respond to the attack, and this adaptively according to what the attacker behavior is. To consider the closed-loop control blocks in a cyber-physical system, actually this is this points to the intrusion detection using the physical properties of the system, rather, which we skipped, and then study federated IDSs for CPS. So if you have more than one IDS, then how can we fuse the information that is coming out of each one of them into improving the performance of the IDS? Okay, and this brings us to the end of the lecture. A little bit fast, but I trust that you will have the chance of going through the material at your own pace thoroughly. So, thanks.